Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Estee Cast, I suppose I'm calling this. I'm not quite sure yet. Starting this up, I'd like to start talking some pop culture on a podcast. So, I'm Steve. Hi. You might remember me from such failed podcast as the Goram Shiny Cast or the Untied Podcast, which don't exist anymore. But guess what? Third time's a charm, right? So, I'm here to talk pop culture, specifically tonight, Game of Thrones. On my own podcast, my own individual podcast, I guess, although I'll certainly be having a cavalcade of guest stars on that you've never heard of before, but hopefully you'll have heard of after this, if that makes sense. So, how you guys doing tonight? Tonight, joining me to discuss the first 5 episodes of the current season of Game of Thrones is my good friend John. John, how are you tonight?
Hey, I'm all right. How are you?
Doing very well, doing very well. And while we're here, Season 6 of Game of Thrones, and I want to give you guys a big spoiler warning right now. I would really hope you are caught up on your Game of Thrones if you're listening to this, but in case you're not, stop listening right now, because we are not discussing anything that... Everything we are discussing spoils Season 6 for you, up to Episode 5, The Door. So if you have not watched even that episode, I would probably stop listening right now, because you are just going to ruin it for yourself, and you're going to be very mad at yourself. And don't be mad at me. It's not my fault. Don't be mad at John. It's not his fault. Right. Don't be mad at us. Don't blame us. In the words of Han Solo, it's not my fault. So, let's get it going. Start off with episode 5 of season 6, The Door. And we'll be talking about the whole season from here, but I was inspired to record a Game of Thrones podcast from this episode because, oh my God, the ending of this episode just killed me, just destroyed me.
It was harrowing, to say the least. I mean, I was sitting on the couch, not prepared, simply and completely not prepared. There were some tears that welled. I will not promise that they fell, because I was not letting them, but there was deep sadness.
Yes, deep sadness is right. I also had tears that welled, which I never thought would happen from Game of Thrones, a show I dearly love, but doesn't exactly pull at the old tear ducts and heartstrings. Yeah. It's not that kind of show, but this, the ending of The Door with, yeah. We've already warned you for spoilers, but one more warning. Stop listening, jerk. The ending of The Door when Hodor stays behind. Dear beloved Hodor stays behind to give Bran and Mira a little more time. Just a little more time to get away, get to safety. My God.
And the fact that they combined his origin story with his farewell.
Right.
You know, this is the first time that, whether you've read the books or just watched the show, that you have ever learned the origin of why his name is Hodor. We've heard tell that he, at least some characters have known that he was struck dumb one day, right? Or I think that might just be a book thing. I'm not sure that ever came up in the show. And specifically, we know that Bran didn't know it was possible, because when he first, I think it was episode 1, when he is exploring back in time, he hears Hodor speaking, you know, full normal words, and was flabbergasted. You know, maybe that's a little too strong, but he was surprised, to say the least.
No, he was definitely surprised, because all he's ever known is this gentle giant who can only say one word and smiles when he says it. And he just seems like a, for lack of a better term, a dullard. And I always assume that he just got hit in the head with a horse kicked him in the head or something. And,
sure. Right. Well, and so I think from the books, I have a strong memory from in reading the books that there was at least at some point someone described him having a fit and him not coming out of it. I don't think they knew what that fit was at the time, which is why it was vague. But man, George R. R. Martin is a bastard for this one.
He is such a bastard.
I love him, but this one hurt.
Well, and he specifically, at least I read this somewhere, and I can't say off the top of my head where I read this, but George R. R. Martin, this was his idea. Like, this wasn't something the show just created.
Oh, no. Oh, I mean, the producers, D.B. Weiss and David Benioff said in a, you know, they have a little thing on HBO you can keep watching for some behind the scenes knowledge and discussion with them, which is a separate topic of how useful that is. But in this particular case, they came right out and said, George told us this, you know, they alluded to a hotel room meeting and that it struck them so deeply that they knew they had to do this. They had to include it in the show and they had to do it justice. I think we obviously, like we said, have not gotten this yet in the books, and we're going to. What I'd be curious, obviously, to see is how George diverges from this vision.
Right. You know? I feel like in a lot of ways he's probably going to try and zig where the show is zagged, because you know, you don't want a redundant experience at this point. And you know, George is obviously, the books came first and they're George's babies. Sure. So he's going to want to do his thing, but, it is such a powerful moment that I wouldn't even mind if it's just exactly this way in the books, yeah. Because I mean, it really just strikes home once you realize what's happening, once you realize that that's why he's saying Hodor. That's, oh my
God.
So, I mean, it's just, yeah, the fact that, and I think that the way that they took that journey, they didn't rush it. They said the full phrase "hold the door" enough times for you, the listener, to just put those syllables together on your own, and you watched his mind dissolve as that young boy. You know, you watched him fall to the point where he was so hit by shock. We should also mention, I think, though, that in the books we get a much cleaner description of the fact how Bran goes back in time and that he's actually going back in time.
Right.
Right. The show kind of left us feeling like it was just a vision. And the magic of the three-eyed raven in the books, it alludes to the fact that the world itself has this memory and can surface this up at any time, but that he's actually, the magic is sending him back to be there, which is how he interacts. So it's not just a static memory.
Right, right. And I mean, you see a little bit of that. They're a little vague in the show, but you see a little bit of that when he calls out to his father at the Tower of Joy. You see that, obviously, when the Night King touches him on the arm and ruins everything.
Yeah, and I think it goes, you know, obviously it's the kind of thing that you're not gonna spend script time on that. That is a level of detail that is not necessary for a television audience to you know, have you tell them spelled out. So I appreciate that they skipped over that. However, it's so fascinating to me with the extra book knowledge that Bran used that power to set up his own escape decades later.
Yeah, yeah, it is really interesting, and I'm so glad that I recently caught up on the books. I think I've read the entirety of the series in the past, I don't know, year and a half. It was a pretty quick amount of time for me, so I'm glad I read them because they have really filled out my knowledge of this thing that I love at this point, and it's a great supplement.
And it's interesting just to see how. This, I think, was the first time this season that the producers have really laid it home that book readers are no longer have an advantage, or if you can even call it an advantage.
Right.
Right.
I mean, book readers, look, the Game of Thrones Song of Ice and Fire, should I say, community tends to be very, I don't want to say smug, but I might say smug about the fact that they have known everything that's going to happen beforehand. And, well, you know, I was shocked when I read that in the book years ago. And hey, I understand. I've read plenty of book series that I have seen adapted into movies and such, and saw things coming. And yeah, I can be that way. It's probably more with comic books with me, giant nerd. But
sure.
Yeah, it's that kind of thing. But yeah, for the first time, and I know some people who read the books first and are now really thrown off by the fact that they're seeing stuff on the show that has not happened in the books yet.
Mm-hmm. Well, we had that right from season one, right? There were people who as book readers, because at the time that term really didn't mean much because everyone was only a book reader up to season one.
Right.
You had that famous scene early in the season between Varys and Littlefinger, and everyone's running around screaming, that didn't happen, that didn't happen. And it took George coming out and saying, it didn't happen in the book because neither Varys nor Littlefinger are perspective characters in the book. That doesn't mean that their interaction didn't happen. And that was a big separation for me in my appreciation of the show, that the show has to show us more, and in shorter bits, which I think we're going to talk a little bit more about, because there's so much happening and so much detail to cover that they have to diverge and they have to create their own stuff at all times because they have to use all of the characters. Otherwise, we only care about the Starks, and they're literally the only person we give any craps about at all.
Right.
And everyone else is just idling our time until we get back to a scene with one of the Starks in it.
Right. And if we only care about the Starks, this is not nearly as good of a show, because you're looking at a show where you don't have those great Brienne and Jaime scenes over back in season three.
Sure.
You don't have all the amazing Tyrion scenes we've gotten over the years. If this is just Stark focused, like a traditional fantasy tale, it's pretty boring.
Well, right. And you know, not to mention the fact that you end up essentially with three main characters who might as well be twins, right? You have, you know, Ned, Robin, and Jon Snow are all the same brooding, loyalty before all, honor bound, you know, fools for the most part, as this world keeps proving them to be.
Right. All been killed also. All three.
Yeah. I will say that the Jon Snow death hit me pretty hard in the book. I thought it was handled pretty well in the show. But at the same time, like, nothing compares to this Hodor one because I wasn't prepared.
Right.
And every other major thing that has happened to date, I either knew it was going to happen or I had a sense that it should happen because I knew these characters and I knew deeper stuff and then things made sense and I could justify and rationalize and all this stuff. And this was the first time that they just ripped the rug right out from under me and left me close to sobbing on my couch.
Well, for me, I was not a book reader, so a lot of these things have surprised me. The only things that I've not been surprised before were, let's see, Ned Stark's death. I mean, that was such a famous event in season one that I watched the show later than a lot of people, where I think I started watching after the first two seasons. So Ned Stark's death, I knew that was coming. It didn't make the scene any worse for me. It was a great scene nonetheless. And I was, a buddy of mine on Facebook, who's a big time troll, went and spoiled Joffrey's death for me, and I was not pleased about that one.
Yeah. Although that one, you wanted that to happen.
Right, right. And honestly, it kind of needed to happen for story purposes too, because
for sure.
Joffrey can only go so far as a character.
Yeah, well, that's interesting. I mean, I kind of want to, you know, bookmark that to talk about these characters, because, I mean, you could say the same thing for Ramsay.
100%.
And yet we keep seeing him just be this, you know, awful bastard who just likes to torment and kill and hurt people.
I mean, you assume he's got to come up and coming at some point, but will it be as good as Joffrey getting poisoned on his own wedding pie?
Right. Yeah, it was the pie. It could have been the wine, but it's basically any number of things. But yeah, I think the pigeon pie was the final.
Pigeon pie, wine, something got poisoned, and Joffrey is dead. That's what matters. He's dead, and we all knew Littlefinger did it, and gloating. Look what I did.
Right, right, right. At least he claims it.
Right. Hey, own up to it.
Yeah. there's not necessarily all of the proof in the world yet that he actually did it, but that's the way the show is going, that he's taking full credit publicly for it.
I mean, the books are they're very vague about a lot of those things, purposefully so, where they don't really like to have a straightforward answer because there's a lot going on. And
well,
it's also
because of that perspective that we were talking about,
right?
Like, we only know in any given chapter what that character knows.
Absolutely. Perspective is huge in these books.
And that's where the show differs drastically, because we are the character. We are the observer, third party of all of this stuff that's happening.
Right.
Instead of being put in their eyes, you know? So like, you know, I think that is why I am nervous about how George is going to pull this off in the book, because he's going to put us in Hodor's head. You know he is. He's going to, through Bran, put us into Hodor's dying head. And I will be a sobbing pool of mush on the floor.
I mean, whenever the Winds of Winter does come out, I mean, you already know you're going to get some weird perspectives. So you're probably going to get that Hodor perspective. You might get a ghost perspective, because a lot of people have theorized that John, once he gets stabbed in the book, jumps into ghost. But
I have also felt that that was going to be something that would happen. But the show did not give us enough of an understanding that he is also a warg, or that the warging thing was a family trait.
Right. Nailed it there, by the way, that the fact that they didn't establish that. So what's the point of doing it on the show?
Exactly. Right. Yeah. They can't, they are setting Bran up as a separate magical entity in and of himself. In the books, every single Stark character that, and we'll include John in that. No, he's not technically a Stark. Every single one of those, we get a perspective dream or nightmare from their wolf. So we know that they all have the capability to warg. It's only John and Bran who actually discuss it in detail, and it's only Bran who actively seeks it out.
Right. Like, we know Arya does it for sure, because she sees through her wolf all the time, as that her wolf terrorizes the countryside throughout A Feast for Crows and A Dance with Dragons, and probably another couple other books too.
Runs into Bran and Troop when they're in that tower.
Yes,
you know, almost finds them, and in you know, that's a whole other thing. Again, we're getting way deep into the books.
We're getting very deep into the books here. This is primarily show, I suppose, but I'm always down for a little book talk. But sure. So let's So the Hodor story is what we started with, and just very, very tragic. And so this puts Bran and Mira Reed on the run in the north, the unforgiving north, the area north of the wall. We're not talking the north. We're talking north of the wall, the wild life. And how the hell do you escape that?
I mean, that's the thing. The place they were was a bastion of solitude and safety from this undeath. And you can't stop death. I mean, you know, the White Walkers being the walking metaphor, literally, you can't stop death. And so stopping it is not what they're going to have to do. I imagine the only thing to do is to have them come back to south of the wall, but we'll see. I mean, I don't know how they do that.
Just get all the Starks back together at Castle Black. It'll be adorable.
Yeah, will it? I don't know.
Or it could be very bloody, and they could all be killed in one fell swoop. Who knows?
I mean, the thing we have to remember is, in this world, if Bran comes back south of the wall, Jon loses any chance of becoming a Stark.
Yeah. In the books, there's always that chance of that magic letter that legitimizes him. But yeah.
Well, and as for Sansa too, like, I mean, so let's why don't we cover all the different things that are happening? I guess
this is a good opportunity to move into the Jon and Sansa territory.
So Bran and Mira are up there on the run. Jon comes back to life through an interesting ceremony of mild awkwardness. just kind of didn't look like anything happened. I did appreciate that they trolled us so wonderfully with cutting his hair at the end of last season. Because his hair had been a thing that Kit Harington's hair had been a thing that people talk about.
Yes.
He's under contract, not allowed to cut his hair. And so at the end of the fifth season, they let him cut his hair. And then in the ritual to bring him back, they just bring cutting bits of his hair off. So it is a slightly shorter look part of the ritual.
Now he's Man Bun John.
Exactly. and I just thought that was kind of a brilliant trolling.
It was a brilliant trolling.
The internet was going to go nuts and say, oh my god, Kit Harington cut his hair, his character's actually dead.
Well, they tried their damnedest to cover up that, you know, they tried to play him like he was dead. We all knew that he wasn't, right. But they
sure
he was a little dead. He was a little dead for a while, but
almost full 24 hours there.
Yeah.
If we're to believe the show, I mean, it went from night to night. So it was almost a full 24 hours he was gone.
Not quite a full weekend at Bernie's, but
yeah.
At least a day off.
Exactly.
The first day off John's had in a long time. So I hope you enjoyed your day off in the darkness, John.
Seriously. Oh, my goodness. So then, you know, related to that whole story, then we have the Red Witch. You know, we'll see what she ends up doing. Obviously, we learned that she is centuries older than she looks, which explains her power, right? Like, it does give us a sense of explaining the magic, that she is not just a mysteriously magical person. Like, she's been at this for hundreds of years.
She's an old head.
Yeah, exactly. we could at least make the assumption that she was part of the, like, the first Andals, the, you know, the men who were fighting the children of the earth, who then brought the White Walkers out. Like, you know, she's as old as those, potentially.
Oh, okay. Potentially. You're saying she's pretty damn old then. You're not saying, like, she's just like an old lady who put on a necklace.
She's a couple hundred years old, I think. She's super old.
Mileage.
And her magic is keeping her sustaining.
And Stannis was with that, huh?
Not so much. Well, he didn't know it. Oh, that's the thing. I mean, she's using her magic to keep this appearance. So no one knows except for us and her.
I'm still judging him.
That's fine.
Yeah. He's dead, so he can't care. Or yeah. Is he? No, he's dead. He's dead. He's very dead.
Brienne is walking around talking about how she cut his head off. And so
she might be carrying Brienne it in a backpack somewhere.
Right. No. Brienne is, if we know nothing else, honorable and truthful. Right. So
she's not much of a liar. She's not Jaime. She's right. Brienne. And that's something she'd brag about. I love how she just went up to Davos and Melisandre. It was like, hey, mm-hmm. Hey, remember that old boss of yours? I killed him. Jerks.
Yeah. And you killed mine. And I know that you did. You know, the whole stare down about the shadow and knowing that blood magic was involved. She's so well aware, but she's currently under oath and they are not her current enemies. So she's not going to do anything about it because she lives by such a strict code.
Yeah.
I can only envision that code is going to get her killed because we've been told that everybody else who has a strict code dies. Right. But
a strict, you know, moral code.
Well, and for her, an ethical code. Moral, ethical, and in a way legal. She actually feels that her knighthood under Renly gives her power. Renly not being there to actually honor it is going to get her in trouble, potentially, but who knows?
I mean, I guess Khal Drogo had a strict code, too, of murdering and raping everything in his way.
Yeah,
that got him killed.
The Dothraki code is an interesting one. I mean, their whole culture is kill until you are killed. Right? Like, that's, if you can take somebody else's power, then they didn't deserve it. You're stronger. You win. They have their rules against weapons, and yet they still didn't care about, you know, such and such a guy got his head bashed into the street. Well, then somebody else was bigger than him and stronger than him. See ya. You know, that's all they cared about.
Too bad.
I mean, and I think that's where, I mean, so let's talk about Dany's thing, right? So Dany disappears at the end of last season. She gets scooped up by this horde.
Khal Drogo Light.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Junior, maybe.
Yeah, I saw somebody on Facebook call him the store brand.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, he was.
He pretty much was. He's generic. Just like, hello.
He's the generic version of Khal Drogo, yeah. Yeah, I mean, so she gets taken in by these guys. She admits that she was the Khal's wife. They then realize that they have to take her back because she's supposed to serve out the rest of her days, you know, living as a meager woman who does not get to do anything at all in her life and is revered as having been touched by a Khal. And it's, you know, wonderfully, you know, patriarchal in an awful way. And just, it's like it's as bad as you could imagine a character as willful as Daenerys is having to deal with. It's exactly what she doesn't want to deal with.
Right.
You know, she sits in the seat of power. No one sits in the seat and tells her what to do. And here they are saying, not only do you not get to sit in the seat of power, you don't even get to see the seat of power. You know, you get to go hang out over here in the medicine tent with the old women.
Hang out with the crones and like it.
Yeah, exactly. And that is exactly what she would never want to do in her life. It's the whole reason why she didn't go back. I mean, she knew that tradition. You know, she had Jorah with her. Jorah knew that tradition.
Yeah.
And she chose to not do it.
What I enjoyed about this whole, you know, the Dany setup there, which, you know, I'm not always the biggest Daenerys fan, but the fact is that they set it up like she was going to have to, you know, stay there with the crones and be stuck there and then get rescued by Jorah and Daario. And Jorah and Daario get there and she's like, I got this. Just lock the door. All right. Fine, guys. I got this. I'm going to set a fire. It's fine. It's fine. I had a plan. Jerks.
This is one of those areas, I think, where it being a TV show and the number of storylines that they're trying to cover leads us to have to take logical leaps on our own. You know, I don't know that she knew going in fire was going to be the way she would kill, but she knew she had to do something. And she knew that they would be meeting all in one place, and she knew that all the calls would be there. And then that was the place to do something if there was a time. Maybe she went in and knew she had to set a fire. I mean, she didn't have any other weapons on her, so I don't know what else she was planning to do. So I guess you're right. So yeah, I mean, I think it's one of those things you can't think about too heavily. Otherwise it falls apart. But it's still, I thought it was well done. I thought it was interesting. It showed that, you know, it showed kind of the part of Dany that took all those cities in the first place, the bloodthirsty part of her, the part that takes power. You know, calls normally kill their call, or people who become a call, they kill their leader. It's 1-to-1. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
She killed 7? 5 or 7? Like,
so a super badass is what you're trying to say.
Exactly. Well, and also the fact that they wove some straight up and down magic into her, right? Like, that, the fact that she can grab onto that flaming pyre and knock it over and not be burned and then walk out of the flaming building unburned.
Right. They have completely set her up as fireproof. She is the dragon is what they're going for. And
right. And it's interesting because the last time that happened, there was talk of sorcery and a red witch was involved and, you know, all these things that you could use to explain it away. In this case, there was none of that. It was strictly Daenerys.
Right. There's no doubt about it. She is fireproof, at least in some way. And it's interesting that you're talking about, you know, maybe Red Witch and everything. And what's going on over in Meereen is you've got Tyrion hiring, for lack of a better term, a Red Witch to represent Dany while she's away.
Right. Exactly. And I think that will blow up in Tyrion's face. I don't think there's any way we get out of this season without her kicking him to the curb over that, because when Dany gets pissed off about stuff, she doesn't exactly, you know, back down. She goes for it until she sees that something is destroyed. And I think encountering another Red Witch is going to set her up to be very, very, very upset. And
well, she's also not going to be very happy about the fact that Tyrion's trying to negotiate with the slavers, which is something that she has not been doing at all. She's pretty much coming in and saying, these are my terms. I've got dragons. You don't want to listen? You could meet my dragons.
Exactly. No, totally. And I think that has been her negotiating strategy to a date. I think Tyrion could advise her and bring her around to the negotiation strategy that he has laid out. But I think the involvement of a Red Witch will make that drastically harder for him to do.
Yeah, I do wonder if everything is coming to a head there, where it's, you know, you're going to have what they call in the books the Battle of Fire, where you've pretty much got all the former slave cities coming in and trying to take down Meereen. And, whatever's happening outside, there's so much going on. They actually called George R. R. Martin trying to figure his way out of it the Meereenese Knot, because it's just so complicated and crazy, everything that's going on there. I'm sure they're going to do a very simplified version, but I have no idea what they're going to do with that.
Well, I think it's going to have to be drastically different, because if you remember in the books, Tyrion's not in the picture.
Right.
He's not there. He isn't
trying to get in there.
He's trying to get in there, but he's not there to interject this this bit of Western, you know, strategy. And let's also acknowledge that in the book, she's quite a bit younger too. So that is a little bit of her impulsiveness, is that she is
a teenager,
you know, she's a teenager still in the books. So, you know, Emilia Clarke is doing, I think, a pretty solid job. You know, people can pick at her acting style and choices she makes. I think a lot of that also goes to the way the character of Daenerys is being written, but she is not a teenager and she's not playing her as a teenager. And yet she's making a lot of the same choices that a teenager makes in the right. source material. So I think it's interesting to see, but it also explains some of the awkwardness, I think, of her storyline. Sorry, go ahead.
No. It's an awkward storyline, but I'm not sure. I don't know. It just feels like they have such a good grasp on everything that happens in Westeros that when it comes to Essos, they're like, foreign weirdness.
Well, if you look at that, so let's compare in the book's material, what is happening in the West is much more action, and what is happening in Essos in the East is all political intrigue, right? The second book, people said, was really slow and really a slog, but the second book was Tyrion ruling over King's Landing.
Right.
It was political intrigue through and through and through. Like, that's all it was.
I think what I enjoyed about that, though, is that Tyrion's got people to play off, where Meereen, it feels like Tyrion's just kind of talking to people, but he's kind of talking to blank slates, to brick walls.
He's being set up to act that way.
Yeah.
Right. He's being set up to act that way. Let's also not ignore the fact that he is this outside white ruler coming in and taking over, you know, a darker skinned people.
Oh, and that's definitely a big factor.
Yeah. I mean, like he is 100% the outsider. He views his knowledge and exploration of culture around the world as, you know, the privilege that it is. But again, it's a massive amount of privilege that these other characters have never even had the inkling of the thought
right.
that they could ever encounter the world the way he does. And he's telling them, it's fine, trust me, it's fine, trust me. And here they are essentially screaming into the wind, you don't know this world the way we do. We grew up here. Our parents grew up here. I know that in Grey Worm doesn't know who his parents are anymore because it's been beaten out of him, but, you know, or at least we're left to believe that he probably doesn't, even though some of his humanity is coming back over the last two seasons.
Right. Through hugs.
These are people who he will not let advise him any more than he is comfortable. And that is wonderfully demeaning to remind us that he is a Lannister and from this world of Westeros.
And he's so much his father's son.
Oh, absolutely. And yet he's one of our favorite characters. Forgive him all of this. Like if he was not, you know, if Peter Dinklage was not playing him, and if Tyrion was not as charming as he is as a character, the things he's doing and saying to them are incredibly disrespectful and incredibly displeasing. And the audience should not like him as much as we do. And yet we trust him. We trust him ever so much to like, he'll solve this. He'll get us out of this. I don't know that that's true.
Peter Dinklage is so good though, as you said, like they hit such a home run finding him. I can't imagine anybody else in this role. And as you said, I can't imagine us liking anybody else in this role as much as we like Dinklage. I almost called him the Dinkles there, but the Dinkles. I mean,
it's interesting to see because, you know, there was a flare up on the internet of Daenerys coming in and being this white savior in a non-white place.
At the end of season 3, I think, where she kind of does the crowd surfing.
Daenerys. Where she revealed that she speaks Valyrian and her dragons lit the slave masters and she ignites the rebellion. I think it's end of season 3. I think you're right.
Yeah, she does that. I think that's like early season 3, and then at the end she frees Meereen, and then they have that whole crowd go like,
they all call her the mother.
Misa, and then she crowd surfs.
Right. And so there's that whole dynamic that they initiated there. Again, in the books, we see a lot of her struggle of just simply not understanding. We can acknowledge she's a teenager. We can acknowledge that there's a lot of different reasons why that isn't as awkward in the books. In the show, it's incredibly awkward. When with what little we're shown, the only reference we have to this character is that she is a child of privilege who wants power and goes after it no matter what.
Now, with this storyline, one of the big differences is how they've killed off Sir Barristan Selmy in the show, but they did not in the books at this point. Sir Barristan plays actually a huge role when Dany goes away and everything shit goes down in Meereen. So I do wonder I don't know. It's an interesting decision in comparison.
I mean, well, they've essentially switched a noble knight for the conniving politician.
Right. Politicians, because you have Varys and...
It's true. You got Varys there as well, which is another thing that is not really the case in the book. Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating that they didn't go that route. I think it's a little bit, it's probably just by actors. They had to involve these actors in something. I think it does make for a more engaging story. I mean, Barristan Selmy, you know, I love him. He's great, but he's not very interesting. And I think it's why we have Meereen viewed as these weak chapters.
Right. He's so noble. He's just the noblest. And that's, that's what got Ned Stark killed. Let's just put it that way.
And I think it's also a factor that we want to keep following Jorah. That Jorah is this character who keeps coming back in the show.
Keeps coming back. Khaleesi!
I think this is the one time where he's not going to come back. I think we're actually not going to see him until next season now. Unless they have set him up to continue being... Because essentially what happened in the show, right? We kept encountering him through others. Mainly through Tyrion. Right? Mm-hmm. He goes off, he kidnaps Tyrion, he runs into Tyrion, he kidnaps Tyrion, they get arrested, they become gladiators, he fights in gladiators,
gladiators for like a week.
Essentially. Right, exactly.
that one was pretty rushed.
Yeah, I'm glad that they acknowledged that with Tyrion this last episode, though, where he said, you know, where Missandei says, you know, have you ever been a slave? And how long have you been a slave? And he said, long enough. And he said, long enough to know. And she said, not long enough to understand. I thought that was a nice dynamic switch there. It's really setting her character up to inform Daenerys when she comes back. You know, but I think in terms of Jorah, there's two directions that the show can go, and I hope it's the one where he's not a bit major character. You either follow him on his major quest that she sends him on to find the cure for stone skin, or he disappears and we don't see him again till season 6 or season 7 or season 8 when he's found the cure for stone skin and he comes back and Khaleesi, I found it, I'm cured, hi, I'm alive. Or he dies.
Hello. Right? I'm missing an arm now, but I'm fine.
Right, exactly. You know what I mean?
Also, I got you an army overseas. Great.
Right. So it's and the reason I hope that they don't make him a major character on his own is because there's just already so much going on.
Right. There's so much going on. We laid out to do this podcast tonight. We laid out a whole list of the major story arcs, and we might even be missing someone here, but we've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. We've got 10 storylines
that we keep encountering, and we've only talked about 4 of them.
Yeah.
Yes.
And the thing is, you could even add some in, but I don't really want Ser Jorah Mormont in there.
Sure.
He should be interacting with people in Meereen, or who knows? Maybe he'll go and interact with the Ironborn. Maybe, but I don't want him on his own.
It wouldn't surprise me if there's a people who know a cure for that. It wouldn't surprise me if it's them, but I don't know. Yeah. Although, you know, they're supposedly coming over to Essos, so why don't we talk about that? So Theon's
Kingsmoot.
He's back with his people
for that was a hot pretty, second.
That's a kind of a lame Kingsmoot, I think, in my opinion.
It was okay. I mean, I kind of expected maybe more than like a handful of people there. And maybe more yelling, because the impression I got from the books is that the Kingsmoot is kind of like if an election just consisted of people yelling, and whoever yelled the loudest won. Mm-hmm. It's like, you're on King!
Yeah, exactly. And also, no one from outside the family threw their head in the ring. Right.
They at least had a few other competitors.
The whole point of a Kingsmoot as an election style is that the throne does not pass from family member to family member. Those family members can vie for it. Sure, go ahead.
Right.
But you are up against whoever else feels they are worthy. And in this case, the only challenger outside was still of the same family name, and so it just doesn't feel quite right. However, it's accurate to the books.
I wonder, I don't know, I think it might have been fun if maybe somebody outside of the family tried for a second and either A, got just completely dismissed on the spot, or gets struck down by Euron, who then walks on.
Right, or struck down by Yara as a proof of her strength.
Right.
All of those things, though, while interesting, are not the point of this story arc, and therefore... You know, I understand why they didn't focus on them.
Right. The story arc pretty much is, nobody wants a queen, and Euron's promising very, very grand things. So, of course, people are going to be like, whoa. He's saying he's going to have the Dragon Queen, and we're going to rule the world? Let's do this.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, they have already very quickly set Euron up as an incredibly intelligent character, which is not a descriptor we would have normally attributed to the Ironborn.
No. The Ironborn are not known for their smarts. They're known for pretty much saying, now we're mostly a people based at sea. So let's go invade the inland north and do nothing with it. They're not smart.
We don't care. Yeah, we don't care about them.
This is the family that Theon Greyjoy came from, guys. I mean, they're not smart because Theon's pretty dumb.
And Theon had a chance. I think if the show is smart, well, maybe not. That's too much for me to say. I think it's interesting to see the difference in Theon and Euron, right? Theon gets made to be a ward of the North. He's taken in by this mainland family. He's raised side by side with their kids. He receives the same education they all did. And yet the treatment he received under Ramsay has stripped him of any sense of self-worth.
Oh yeah, he's just a quivering mass at this point.
Right. That essentially puts him back as if he's had no education at all. He doesn't know how to put coherent thoughts together sometimes. And yet, if you were to go back to season one, he was trading quips and barbs with the Stark boys as fast as any of them.
Oh yeah, he was such a cocky prick in season one.
Oh, you know, you hate him. You hate him.
I really did not like him. And then I hated him in season two when he just decided, well, you know, this family raised me, but I guess I was technically a hostage. So let's take my abusive father's side.
Yeah, he does what so many characters have done, which is he attempted to grasp power. And it's this interesting thing that keeps coming up in the show is there are characters who understand how power works and they understand how to grasp for power, and then there are other characters who do not understand how it works. I mean, you know, go back to you know, the attack on the bay when you have Cersei imparting her decades of knowledge to Sansa, her decades in the court of having been a woman married off to you know, better her father's position in the court. Giving off all of this knowledge to Sansa about how horrible her life will be and how she's still just such a pretty little girl and isn't thinking about the world in the proper way. And that has factored into the way Sansa sees the world now. You know, you combine that with the physical torment and emotional torment that she went through in the last season. Damn right she's got an edge to her.
Oh, yeah.
And you know, for lack of a better descriptor, the ordeal of the last season has burned off any of her childish joy and approach to the world, and she is as hard as any of them. And can I say my theory about her?
Go right ahead. I am all for theories.
I think she's gonna kill Jon Snow.
Oh, whoa!
Or set him up to die. She's going to play him like a fiddle because he is, yeah, because he's not a Stark. If he ever becomes a Stark, he stands in her way of becoming the Warden of the North.
She's buttering him up by making like a dire wolf like cloak for him and stuff like that. Like, here you go, John, you're one of us now, buddy.
I don't think she's intentionally, because I don't want it to seem like it's evil. That's the thing is, you know, this show does such a solid job of conveying what George had in his original vision is that people who want power are not inherently evil for wanting that power.
Right.
It's the means that justify the means that dictate the ends, right? How you go after that power. I'm not saying that she's intentionally trying to end John's life, but I do not think she will ever let him become a Stark. And I think she will let him go off and rally troops around him. As, you know, a bastard son is still better than a woman in many of the Northmen's eyes.
Right.
And, you know, as much as we talk about, like, look at what her worth was. Her worth is as a childbearer. She's smart enough to know that she can't just be that. You know, she's there's more meant for her in the world than to simply be the token wife with the Stark name who gives birth to you know, Stark plus whatever other famous house. She doesn't want that life. And Jon Snow will be able to rally an army around him. He will be able to run off to war and die on her behalf, leaving no one else but her to take the reins and take up the Stark name and leave her in a better negotiation place. So I think the comment she makes about, "I made you a cloak just like father wore," is setting Jon up to act like his father, and his father honored himself to a dishonorable death.
What's interesting about your theory is that Sansa is so much her mother's daughter, and Catelyn famously has always denied Jon Snow any part of the Stark heritage. And
hated him. Not only denied him, like viscerally hated him. Yeah.
I mean, it's even more palpable in the books. Like in the books, she flat out hates his guts. And when Rob suggests making Jon a legitimate Stark, she balks at the idea. This is the worst idea she's ever heard.
For sure. And I think that's where again, you know, when Sansa shows up and Jon and Sansa hugged immediately, the book reader in me bristled at that because she did the same as her mother, not to the same degree, but, you know, they did then have that reconciliation scene where she said, "I was awful to you. All right, fine. You acknowledge it at least. And I can move on and I can stop being such a whiny book reading now."
But you're right, though. They did not have the same relationship that he had with Rob or Arya. Arya and Jon were super tight. But going to the classic book theory of Jon's parentage, that's probably because Arya is so much like Lyanna Stark.
Sure, sure. Ooh. And I think... right?
Ooh, R plus L equals J. Oh.
Well, and I think it's interesting also, like, you know, compare who their role models are, right? Who they came up with. Sansa's influence were her mother, Catelyn, and Cersei Lannister, for better or for worse. Those are the women who influenced her life. Jon Snow was influenced by his father, well, were assumed his father, Ned Stark, the person who we were told who claims to be his father.
Yes. At least father in how he was raised.
Yeah, in name. He was raised as Ned Stark's bastard. And the commander of the Night's Watch, who took him in, whose name is completely eluding me right now.
The other Mormont.
Yeah.
The old bear. That we're calling him now, the old bear?
The old bear was definitely one of his nicknames.
Yeah, God. Mormont. Lord Commander Mormont. Great. Yeah. Good enough.
So,
he's dead.
So, yeah. He was also an influence.
Lord
and
commander
again,
of the Night's Watch.
We're seeing this traditional view of honor. Right. And Mormont got himself stabbed in the back by his people. Jon got himself stabbed in the back by his people. And
in the front.
In the front. You're right. Actually.
Really? Jon got stabbed everywhere.
Yeah. So, you know, do I think my theory will actually pan out? Probably not. I what do I know? But it's something that I think is fascinating to watch their differences. You know, people are trying to make a whole big thing. Why wouldn't she tell him that she ran into Littlefinger? Why wouldn't she do that? She has learned to keep her cards close to her chest. She has learned how to play with power. Makes sense to me why you don't tell everybody, because she wasn't alone in a room with Jon, for one. And what does Jon stand to gain from knowing her source of information? Right? Like, there's no benefit to her or to him that Jon Snow knows that Littlefinger's around.
Right. Does Jon only... even know Littlefinger's reputation? Like, oh, I heard that name. He's supposed to be
He's probably gotten the ravens that the...
That's true. He was Lord Commander for at least like a week.
Well, and also, let's also note that by not admitting that that Littlefinger's back, that Littlefinger has mustered the armies of the Vale and brought them out,
right,
or is in the process of bringing them out. She didn't tell him about that. Nope. She didn't tell him about any of that. I don't know that she knew, actually. I can't remember that scene well enough.
Do you think Littlefinger is lying about the Blackfish having reassembled an army at River Run?
No, I don't think so.
Okay, you think he's actually being honest for once?
I think...
I mean, obviously he has an agenda in saying that. He always has an agenda.
Oh, that's interesting. I hadn't really thought about it. I don't think he's lying about the truth of the fact that River Run is retaken because the Lannisters have been falling apart and Tywin Lannister is there to pay the bills. And I can see a lot of ways why logistically in the war things would start to turn back against the Lannisters. However, that is not to say that I think he doesn't have an ulterior motive for sending her south.
Right. I also wonder, I mean, obviously there's been divergences with the book, but sure. The Blackfish had, in his at least last appearance in the book, had a great little scene where he showed up when Jaime Lannister came knocking on his door when Jaime was doing his reclamation tour of the North, and or I guess the Mid-North or whatever the hell you call the Riverlands. Yeah, the Riverlands. Let's just say the Riverlands. And I really liked the standoff they had there, so I wonder if we'll get a version of that scene coming up, because for all we know, River Run might have the Blackfish ruling it again, but it might be completely surrounded.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. We'll see. I mean, again, then we're back to this whole conversation of how many main characters do they really want to have in a show that is only 1 hour long, 10 episodes a season.
Right. But I think what would be interesting is to, and they did this in a way in the book where you bring Brienne and Jaime, who forged a friendship over difficult times, you bring them at odds with each other. Mm-hmm. So I wonder if they are going to do a version of that. I think that would be interesting if they could make it work, but it does not seem like Jaime's going anywhere right now, unless until they settle everything over at King's Landing.
No, there's no way. Yeah, and which, I mean, the preview at least tells us that something gets altered in King's Landing next week. So
I mean, they have to. They didn't even touch on it in this last episode.
Which I think actually, so, you know, in the sense of talking about this episode, I liked that. I liked that we were like, here's 4 of the 10 possible storylines. We're focusing on them and only them. It made the episode better.
Yeah, I agree. And this show, you know, as we've said, one of its main faults is that it can be a little too scattered sometimes, where you'll get like a check-in with like, oh, here's a minute with Sam. Here's a minute with Arya. Or, you know,
right.
It can be a little much sometimes.
For sure. Well, it's okay. You just brought up Arya. That's like, we have seen so little of her this season, and yet what we have seen has been huge. She's being tested in this fantastic way, and she is so far passing the test. What I think they're leaving us to assume is that she will not become a completely brainwashed individual like it appears all the other faceless men are.
Right.
That she will still remember her history. I mean, it's not an accident that they sent her to a theater to see the retelling of her father's death.
Oh, absolutely. And you can tell not that hits home with her, and it still affects her. And they are looking for any chinks in that armor that she might still have emotions. She might have Stark feelings still.
Right. Exactly. And so I think, I personally think that she is going to pass and get eventually all of the abilities that becoming a faceless man gets you.
Get her assassin certification.
Yeah, essentially, right? And get, you know, you get to take your face off. Cool. whatever the hell comes with that. But I do think that she will still retain, you know, some sense of her personality. I mean, if for no other reason than I'm going to be a greedy book reader and say she'd be an awful perspective character if she was actually devoid of all personal feelings.
Oh, yeah, 100%. I mean, that's not something you can read a book about. Like, yeah, who wants to read that? No one.
Right, no one. But
and what, part of what makes Arya so compelling is the fact that she has had so much happen to her, and she has so many feelings about everything, mostly vengeful feelings. She's a very angry young lady.
Well, and she, through her, we're learning how, essentially, if you look at all of the Stark children, they are all the possible ways that a person can emotionally process grief, right?
Right.
The grief of having your entire family torn away from you. You know, you have Rob, who tries to fight to get it back. You have Rickon and Bran, who just scamper. you have Sansa, who tries to play the game to get power in the long form. You have Arya, who tries to go for straight up blood, but not as boldly and stupidly as her brother. And then you have Jon Snow, who's just unfortunately left off in the woods because we need to remember that he's not actually a Stark yet.
Well, if anything, I think he might be acceptance, because he wants to feel these feelings. He wants to go off and fight this war, but he's made a vow and he can't do it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. It's a good point. Yeah. But yeah, I think it's interesting to see how that all works out, though.
Yeah. Well, there's what I have to say with Arya is there's a reason that her sword Needle is still around and it's not at the bottom of the ocean.
Right.
It's still there, and that's the remnant of her Starkness in there. So I have no idea what the long game is for Arya. It's a complete mystery. Yeah. You can form a general outline for Jon and Sansa and Cersei and all that, but for Arya, that's a big old question mark.
Yeah, no, it definitely is. I mean, it's a challenge for them as writers and producers of the show to tell an interesting, compelling story, and I think it's why they've been peppering it so much. Why they kind of shy away from it when there isn't as much to tell. We could argue that they've done the same thing with the whole Dorne storyline, which we didn't even write down on our list of 10 possible storylines.
God, that's 11.
Yeah, I think that's 11, yeah, and there's a reason that it was last, because it's not good.
It sucks. It's so bad. And the thing is, it wasn't that good in the books, but the shows has just been a complete waste, which they pretty much acknowledged at the beginning of the season when they just straight up murdered Prince Doran.
Yeah, yeah. Except have you heard the whole the Dornish plot theory?
No, I have not. Well, wait. Are you talking on the show?
No. That there's a theory on the internet that the Dornish are behind everything that goes wrong.
I've heard that one on the internet because I spent a couple months on the Reddit Song of Ice and Fire threads, and oh my god, that you can quickly lapse into madness reading that.
Oh yeah.
There's some interesting stuff on there for sure.
There's some interesting stuff from the book perspective that the Dornish are somehow actually twisting all of the strands of supposed fate and causing everything. What I think is also interesting, though, is that in the show they've decided to not do that. What I think is unfortunate is that they've taken these characters, the Sand Snakes, and they are wonderful characters in the book. They are wonderful, young women who are proving that not all of Westeros treats their women the way that King's Landing treats their women, the way that the North treats their women, the way that the Riverlands, that no, in Dornish land, they are these weird outcasts of darker skinned people who, I don't know, believe in equality. It's kind of strange. And
a woman ruling things.
And we don't get any of that in the show.
Right.
These women from a fight choreography standpoint, their fights have been some of the weakest in the entire show.
God,
and I don't
they've
know.
Been so bad. Now, and been, I don't understand why they wouldn't introduce Princess Arianne.
Right. Yeah.
Because she's a very good character. She's one of the best Dornish characters, and to exclude her entirely, and I can understand cutting Quentin out. I can completely understand that because Quentin's storyline is we might as well just say it. It ends with an O. It does feel a bit like a side tale. It's very tragic for sure, but you don't need Quentin on the show. I mean, who's the other one? Tristane?
Yeah, Tristane.
I actually am a little surprised they didn't maybe try and send Tristane over to Daenerys this year to maybe, I don't know, do something with that.
That's the kind of thing that Doran would have done, and Doran was, they decided, I guess, not. Either they decided he wasn't very good, or the audience just straight up wasn't responding to him.
I thought he was an okay.
Dr. Bashir is great. I love that guy.
Yeah, he was a good actor. I always expected Prince Doran to be kind of a portly fellow because he could never walk anywhere.
He's got gout, and I know that gout does not only afflict heavy set people, but it is one of those things that is in our mind's eye when you think about it. You think of historical figures who have gout. They tend to get more rotund because they can't move.
Right. You can't. It's just a fact. But besides that, I thought he did a pretty good job portraying the prince. And I'm surprised they didn't maybe give him at least a little bit of an edge. Because the thing is, that's all a front kind of he obviously still has gout, but he uses that. He uses that image of himself to have people underestimate him and think, well, he couldn't be up to something, but he's really got the. That speech he gives in the book where he, where he reveals his entire plot to Arianne is fantastic. I love that. That made the whole Dorne thing worth it for me in the book. And the fact that he didn't get that moment on the show is maybe one of the biggest flaws with the show.
Yeah. I mean, it's just means that they have, calling it a flaw with the show goes back to this whole that we have to compare the books and the show. We've we have reached beyond that point now.
And that's one of the things I've really liked about this season is that we've gone beyond that point.
Yeah, I think that there is something to be argued that with coming up with their own source material, the writing has not been as strong this season. I'm in a way, this is season one again, right? Like most shows, when the writers are first getting their groove together, are kind of rough. You expect that from a brand new show. The actors have to figure their shit out. The writers haven't quite figured out how to gel with each other episode to episode. Things feel inconsistent sometimes or rushed other times. All of that is a reality of a first season. We're seeing a lot of that stuff happen this season because of, as we mentioned, these 11 different storylines that have been jostled around in a 1 hour episode they literally get 10 hours to tell all of this. There are more main storylines than there are episodes, right?
True.
They can't even format the show in such that we just follow Jon Snow for an entire hour and then never see him again. They can't do that. So we're seeing a lot of this newbie kind of issues in this season and this is the first time I'm kind of voicing that for myself. And I'm realizing that I think has been why I'm a little bit dissatisfied this year.
Huh. Interesting. Cause I've actually felt the opposite. I've actually been incredibly satisfied by most of the episodes, but maybe that's the fact that I just love a good shock ending, and they've revealed they've had quite a few of those.
And I will say though, the one that I think they botched was the whole John walking off and being like, "Oh well, my watch has ended." You know, Arya's reveal of getting her eyes back was such a stronger way to end that episode,
right?
In my opinion, there's things like that, but no, it's cool. I mean, there's a lot of people who love this season. There's a lot of good things happening this season. I just happen to be on the side of people who are kind of like, I'm not entirely thrilled with it. I don't dislike it as much as I dislike the second season, but that's for various different reasons.
Yeah, the second season's got some great moments thanks to Tyrion mostly. Tyrion is a delight throughout the second season, but it's certainly not the best adaptation. They struggle with the adaptation there. Where the first season is kind of like a perfect, nearly perfect adaptation of the first book, the second season is rough.
Well, and I think in this season we're also seeing more standard tropes of filmmaking, not even necessarily fantasy or sci-fi, but just strictly if you're doing an action, suspense, horror film scene. I mean, this whole final episode that we just saw, how many movies have we seen the like scaling the walls, crawling down a hallway to the final character who's going to sacrifice themselves so that the others can escape? Like, I think that's part of why the Hodor thing caught me so off guard is because, oh man, I'm rolling my eyes. You just threw Bran's wolf away without a violent death. You just threw away the last child of the forest.
The forest.
You just killed off the final child of the forest, as far as we know, in a trope, standard way to, I will be the last bastion. I just happen to have this last grenade in my pocket, blah, 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 And then you hit us.
Now that I think about it.
And the way it was shot with the look down the hallway with suddenly the undead who have prior to this primarily been more zombie-ish in their manner of scaling. Although there was that break when John went far north and they were much more active in their ability to kill, which I think is what caught them all off guard there. But it was boring to me. It could have been done stronger, I thought, which is why I think when Hodor's moment comes up, I was floored because I wasn't expecting them to end on such a strong place.
Interesting. I'm realizing now how tropey it was, but when I watched it, I was enjoying it, but
that's the thing with tropes, they are enjoyable.
It's definitely a little more television-y, that's for sure.
Yes.
They are definitely, it's the television writer's room again, and for better or worse, for someone like me, I'm probably a little more like, yeah, show me them blood and guts. I've been getting that, but I guess if you're looking for a little more literary approach, this definitely has not, seeing more television tropes. And I know a few people that are, not as thrilled as I am with it.
No, absolutely.
They're certainly not the subtlety, that's for sure.
Right. And I think that's fine. I mean, the thing is, this has been the ongoing contention about book readers and TV watchers is book readers want it to somehow be an expansion of their literary thing. And it can't be. Right. At some point, you have to cut things shorter. What I think was interesting about this season for me so far has been that it has felt safe. Like, I feel like they are making safe choices with how they treat all the various characters and what they do to them all. And,
you know, interesting. So like, how do you feel? Name an example. What do you think has been safe so far?
So Jon Snow comes back and he's his same old moody self.
Okay. So that was a question
to make him. He could have come back fire and brimstone and been, or some other, pick any other adjective where he's much more, active.
Right. And instead he's just like, he's
just pissed that he died.
right. I was expecting him to maybe be a little more, I don't know, not quite alien, but maybe disconnected from the world or odd, something off.
And still could. He absolutely still could. And I think maybe that also could just be part of the fact that we're spreading his timeline out because there's so much going on. So, you know, but, you know, with the brand, the tropes there and the brand thing, like, again, the master teaching the child going off on their adventure without the master's watchful eye. It's the Icarus story all over again, right? Icarus flew too close to the sun despite his father's warnings. Bran went into this place despite the numerous warnings of you can get lost in here. You can get stuck here. You cannot come back sometimes. Now, was he ever particularly warned that the Night King can see you and touch you? No, he was not. Was he ever warned that the Night King
might have been good information, entrance? To be honest?
No. Right, of course. But
maybe if you grab onto this branch and you see a king of the undead, maybe run. Out. Yeah, maybe get out of there, buddy. Might be a good idea.
If you drop down in the ocean to go snorkeling and you see 17, you know, hammerhead sharks all swimming over there, maybe get back in your boat.
Yeah, because but I'm not really here, so
to go swimming.
These hammerhead sharks can't eat me because I'm only like seeing this in my mind's eye.
Yeah, so I mean, it was an interesting thing.
I'm using the force.
It's a standard trope. The youthful student,
right?
You know, disobeying the master, paying a price.
Right.
I'm just really pissed off that price was Hodor, man.
Hodor. Yeah, I'll miss Hodor. I had a buddy who, you know, it took him three seasons to realize that Hodor only said Hodor. So I'll miss precious moments like that.
He's not gone, Steve.
He's always with us.
No. He's been killed by the undead.
Oh, no, not undead Hodor.
His body has not been burned, and they're not eating him. They're just killing him. So Hodor is coming back.
No.
Sounds you're making know that you that I speak the truth.
some are gonna be undead too. That's not good.
We've seen the undead horses, so yeah, they could bring the direwolf back.
And in the books there's that undead bear, which is a crazy visual that I would love to see in the show in any way they could represent that, because that's one of the crazy things that I read in the book that I'm like, okay, I want to see that. I don't know how you do that, but get it done.
Right, for sure. Yeah, it's interesting to see. I mean, there's
an ice bear zombie,
right? I love it. But yeah. Well, we've covered a lot.
We have. No, this has been a productive conversation for sure, and not forced, which I like. I hate when it's just like, well, now it is time for the next topic. What is that topic?
Yeah.
No, I think this is a good discussion of the first five episodes of Game of Thrones season 6. So I'm not sure how often we're going to do this. I mean, if people listen, I don't know who's going to listen. I don't know what's good. But if people listen, they want more, let me know. I will record more. But at worst, John, I'd like to record another at the end of the season at worst.
Yeah, I'm down for
good,
sure.
Good stuff. We didn't even touch on Sam and Gilly and Sam's fat pink mask, but who cares? They've appeared in one scene where Sam was vomiting.
Yeah, exactly. Nothing really has happened.
You know what? Final topic. What's up? Ramsay's got Rickon. What's happening there?
A last-ditch effort to make Ramsay actually seem like an important character. they do nothing interesting with him except he attempts to grab power in the most brutal and awful way. He torments people. He's just, they're writing a character that is pure evil. And pure evil isn't very interesting. Pure anything isn't very interesting.
Right.
So he's, right now, Ramsay is a dog-marked page to say, well, Jon and Sansa have to go here now. You know, because otherwise, what is actually pulling them to Winterfell? He's serving a plot point. He's serving a purpose. That's all he's doing.
Well, I hope he tries to have a big old dinner party where a few people go mysteriously missing, and then big fat Wyman Manderly shows up. And I do really enjoy
pies.
I want Frey pies.
You want the Frey pies?
I want the Frey pies. Give me the Frey pies. That's all I want. If they give me Frey pies, I'll be such a happy boy. They're not going to, but I would love it.
If we keep this going and we don't add somebody who hasn't read the books to the conversation, we're going to have to start a tally of how many times we make reference to book things that have just not been part of the show. And just so that the audience can be like, yeah, they were really annoying when they did that. Sorry, guys.
My bad. Yeah, the Frey pies. I love the Frey pies. Okay, so I do thank you for listening. If you have any comments, questions, any of that stuff, hit me up on Twitter. That's the best place. You can find me at Estebom. Estebomb, or you can hit me up on my Facebook fan page, which a whopping like 30 people like, so who cares?
Hey, everyone but starts somewhere.
Everyone starts somewhere. It's Steve Jacot, last name J-A-C-O-T. So please, feedback would be appreciated. If you want to hear more, let me know, and we will record more. But I enjoyed this. John, it's been a pleasure, buddy.
Thank you, Steve.
All right, guys. Thanks a lot for listening.